You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We've got a great show for you today, including Ditchling-based Annabel Thorpe talking about her historical fiction set in Italy and how her work as a travel journalist has informed her writing. We talk to Judy Upton about her Sussex-based mystery series and to Tom Johnston about how he uses Brighton's unseen history to write his short fiction. We also hear from Sam at Brighton Waterstones talking about their jam-packed event programme in April and May. And we also talk to Anna Jefferson from New Writing South, who is back to discuss their Publishing and Industry Day, which is a must-go-to for all aspiring authors in Sussex. You can follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club, where you'll find details and links to everything we've discussed on today's show. If you've got an idea for the show, you can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Italy in World War II. Hidden loves and dangerous secrets, suspicion and lies swirl around Trattoria Casa Maria as the Nazis tighten their grip on power. Family-run Casa Maria is the beating heart of beautiful Amatino in Umbria, but now it is under Nazi control to the fury of matriarch Eleanor Capaldi. Forced to give board to a hated young German soldier, she reluctantly realises he shares her passion for cooking and can be a real help. But should an enemy soldier ever be trusted? In Rome, Eleanor's charismatic grandson Giorgio is undercover at the other family trattoria, leaving his new wife Sophia to keep the secrets of his whereabouts. Amantino is seething with conspiracies, and some would happily bring down the Capaldis and all they stand for. In war, there are always people ready to do business with the enemy. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Annabel Thorpe, and congratulations on the publication of The Moonlit Piazza, the sequel to The Village Trattoria. Can you tell us about the book?
Yes, thank you for having me on the book club. I'm delighted to be here. The Moonlit Piazza is a sequel, as you said, to The Village Trattoria, and it continues the story of the Capaldi family who live in a small town called Amatino in Umbria. And it's set in 1943. And 1944 in the Second World War, at a time when Italy was kind of almost under occupation by the German forces, because when Mussolini fell, the Italians actually changed sides, and they'd been fighting with the Germans and they went across the side with the Allies. So this is a really traumatic time in Italian history, and it's a story of one family and one town and the impact it has on all of them.
And when did the idea come to you, and why Italy?
Well, I'm a travel writer in my day job, and so this is my fourth book, and I've always set them abroad. And I like to create stories wrapped around sort of dramatic scenarios, because I think that's when characters are at their most interesting. So my first book was set around the Croatian Civil War in the 1990s. But there's obviously a lot of fiction around Second World War, but a lot of it is, about what happened in France and Germany, and less so in Italy. And I just think it's absolutely fascinating what happened there, and that really we know so little about it. So it was a great research project for me. And then, you know, everybody loves writing about Italy. So, you know, it was an absolute joy.
Can we hear an extract, please?
Absolutely. So this is from the beginning of the book, and the entire town has come out for a procession to celebrate Santa Lara's Day as a way of kind of showing sort of defiance towards the Germans who are in the town. As the procession moves across the square and onto Via Cavour, the voices of the choir boys rise, a sweet melancholic chant echoing off the crumbling walls, hushing the children's chatter, the flames in the lanterns like burnished feathers suspended behind the glass. Cat glances behind them. The street is filled with people, scarlet and gold flags swinging above a sea of woolen caps, young children hoisted onto their father's shoulders. Just as she is about to look away, she catches sight of Eleanor and Vittorio walking towards the back, their faces turned towards each other, deep in conversation. The skin prickles unpleasantly on her arms. "Ti amo, Amatino," says Sophia, her breath spooling out into the frozen air. "Isn't this one in the eye for Messel? He'll never break our spirit." Cat nods, glancing up at the weathered houses, their ancient frontages made new by the sparkling coat of snow. That they have stood for centuries seems extraordinary to her. After the angular modernity of New York, the scale of Italy's past is like a character she has yet to quite understand. Above the rooftops, the leaden sky is empty, save for a lone plane in the distance, the muffled whine of its engine just audible above the choir boy's chant. Messerschmitt? Maybe. Dropped all his bombs and heading home, I suppose. Sophia rolls her eyes. I don't know how they sleep. That's not a Messerschmitt. Bertelli takes off his hat and peers upwards. In fact, I don't think it's German. You think the Allies have had another go at Terni? Kat shakes her head, thinking of the newsreel she watched the previous day. Bodies in the street. Houses crumpled in on themselves, as if crushed by a giant, unseen boot. There'll be nothing of that town left. He's not coming from Terni, says Bertelli. I'm not sure I like the look of this. Kat spins round. The plane is nearer suddenly, lower in the sky, its nose dipped towards Amatino. Dio, is he coming for us? I wouldn't wait to find out, says Bertelli. I'd get out of this, now. As the whine of the engine grows louder, the procession begins to splinter. Faces upturned, children scooped up. Within seconds, the atmosphere has turned to one of panic and fear. As people push and shove, the statue of Santa Lara crashes to the ground, sending up razor-edged chunks of cheek and bone, embedding them into the flesh of those nearby. Bertelli's hand is in Kat's back, propelling her forward, her fingers locked around Sophia's. Down there, he points to where a crowd of men have wrenched open a cellar door. Andare, andare. Where's Elena and Vittorio? A deafening explosion rips across Kat's words, the ground shaking so violently beneath her feet that she cannons into Sophia, almost throwing them both to the floor. I'll find them, shouts Bertelli, as a second explosion roars up the street towards them. Just go, both of you. For God's sake, run.
Thank you so much, Annabelle. That's such a wonderful extract. So as you mentioned, you are a travel journalist, and I'd love to know a bit more about how your journalism experience has helped inform your fiction.
I think massively, because, you know, one of the things as a travel writer is you're all about really trying to get under the skin of a destination and bring it alive for people through your writing. And that's one of the things that I really feel quite strongly about with my fiction, is that the locations are almost like another character. And I've always loved traveling through fiction, even, you know, since I was, you know, the youngest reading books that I loved were set abroad. But I think it's really important to kind of create a realistic picture of a destination, the good and the bad, you know, and real specific. So you can sort of, you can hear the bird song and you can, you know, smell the air and you can feel the light. I think that's what my travel journalism, you know, has, how that's filtered into my fiction, is to really create a sense of place.
Absolutely. What was your journey to publication like? Was it difficult to get into being published in a different form?
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. So I think it took me, so I always wanted to write novels ever since I was a little girl. And in my 20s, I sort of embarked on journalism, I thought, as a way to just earn some money while I got my first novel published, which took about 20 years. I mean, literally, I would say from really seriously starting my first book, it took me about 10 years to get published. It's for me, it was a very, very long road. I took one of the Curtis Brown writing courses, which I'd really recommend, which really helped. And then, you know, it was about 2 or 3 years between getting an agent and finally getting a deal.
Yes, it's very rarely straightforward, isn't it? I would love to know about the best work trip you've ever been on.
That's so difficult to, I mean, I would say I went to India, 2 or 3 years ago. I'd never been before, and it was absolutely eye-opening. And I think, you know, as so many destinations become more similar, with sort of globalization and that kind of thing, India was just like stepping into a tsunami of life and smells and sights. And I was on a tour with a company, with a group of women, and they were all sort of older women in their 60s and 70s, and they were fabulous. They were all adventuring. And it was just a great experience that you know, and also I think to have been traveling for 25 years, never have got to India, and then to go was a real lesson in that, you know, there is endless world to explore. There's always somewhere new to go. And when you do, it's just eye opening, however much you've traveled. So, yeah, so India really stands out for me.
And where do you write? And in your dream world, where would you write your next book?
Well, I write everywhere, because you kind of have to, because most people who write fiction they don't, you know, that's not all they do. So you have to, because it doesn't pay very well, so you have to have another job. So I write on the train, I write on aeroplanes, I have an attic at home that my husband sort of did up for one of my birthdays and painted it all and made it all lovely. And I have a view of the downs from my window. So I spend a lot of time writing there. And I've been very fortunate for a couple of my books, often with the last month or so when I'm really tidying them up. I go away to Turkey, which is one of my favourite countries in the world. And I have a little hotel that I've known for years, and I go and stay there and just sort of sit up on the terrace and finish them off. So that's my happy place to write. It's called the Courtyard Hotel in Kaukan. And I love it.
Gosh, that sounds lovely. So you are born and bred Sussex and you now live in Ditchling. And I'd love to know a bit about what it's like to be part of the community there.
Ditchling is it. I had no idea really when I moved in. It's an extraordinary place. It's a real village with a heart. We're very lucky. We have two pubs. We have two cafes. You know, we've got vineyards on the doorstep, but it's a village that really cares about, you know, the kind of the life of the village and the soul of the village. There's endless sort of clubs that you can join. And it just has a real sense of community. And I think the fact it's got this very strong artistic history is really important. And so I feel really privileged to live here. It was just in the Telegraph as one of their top 30 villages to live in the country. So I feel very lucky, even if occasionally it does feel a bit like an episode of Midsummer Murders.
What's next for you, Annabelle? What are you working on?
Well, actually, at the moment, I'm working on a non-fiction book, which is coming out next year. It's called The Great Escape, and it's a social history of the British love affair with holidays, starting right in the Regency period, with the spa craze in Bath and Buxton in the sort of 17th century, and then coming right up to the present day and looking at all aspects of holidays, from holiday camps to Victorian seaside to cruise ships. And I've, you know, been up and down the country and interviewing all sorts of people. And it's just been fascinating. So I'm really looking forward to that coming out.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on copies of your books?
So the book is out. The Moonlit Piazza is out tomorrow. It's available on Amazon and hopefully all good bookshops. And I'm at Instagram at AnnabelleThorpe20 for pictures of occasional travels and mostly my cat.
Thank you so much for joining us, Annabelle.
Lovely to be on. Thanks, Anna.
When wildlife detection dog Casper loses his sense of smell, his owner calls in Sophie Gorridge and Brownlow. Sophie is a pet detective and Brownlow is trained to sniff out lost and stolen dogs and cats, but this assignment is very different. He'll need to search for owl pellets and hedgehogs on a Sussex farm that a TV presenter is rewilding. It should be straightforward survey work, but when Sophie sees two figures in camouflage gear emerge from the tree line carrying ropes and large crate, she suspects they're up to no good. It's only when a friend mentions that two climbers have tried to steal the peregrine falcon chicks from the tower of Chichester Cathedral that Sophie realises what she witnessed is likely to have been a theft of young birds of prey. Now she and Brownlow find themselves in a menacing underworld where peregrines, goshawks and even eagles are being stolen for use in falconry, the sport of kings. The trade in wild caught birds is extremely lucrative, and despite the pet detective setting a clever trap for the thieves, soon it is they who become the prey. Judy, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations on the publication of the third book in the Brownlow Sussex-based series.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a bit about Sophie and Brownlow?
Yeah, Sophie's a pet detective. She lives in the Maisonette on the outskirts of Brighton, and her sniffer dog's called Brownlow. She really prefers animals to people, so this is the ideal role for her. The only person she's close to is a guy called Quinn James, who runs the local wildlife and pet rescue centre. Brownlow himself came from the rescue centre. He's a big shaggy mongrel who a soldier brought back from Afghanistan, and he's named after the soldier that rescued him, so that's why he's called Brownlow. And he's her sniffer dog, so he goes out with her when she's looking for stolen dogs and lost cats.
Let's talk a bit about the role that Brighton plays in your writing. What did you find out in your research when you were setting it here?
I just thought Brighton is such a great place, really, to set something because it's got the natural world all around it, and the city with so many different locations. I had to research yachts at the marina for this one, and also climbing shops, without outdoor activities. I've had to go and research all of that, and other locations this time. I've gone a little bit further afield. Slightly more exotic. I've gone to Lewes, Chichester, because they have peregrine falcons nesting on their cathedral. There's also peregrine falcons nesting on Sussex Heights, the large block of flats in central Brighton. So, and they have a webcam on them. So I did some research watching their webcams. Pagham Harbour Nature Reserve also comes into it, and I've had to go there. And there's also the odd jet setting location. So the Isle of Wight's in it, and the New Forest as well. She does travel a little bit further afield. She gets as far as Hampshire in this adventure.
So this is the third book in the series. Did you always know that Sophie and Brownlow would become part of a series, or did it develop naturally?
It developed naturally. I wrote a short story that was published in an anthology, and completely fell in love with Sophie and Brownlow while I was doing it. So then I decided that they ought to perhaps have a bigger adventure. So I was only thinking about one book, and there was a story in the news where Lady Gaga's dogs had been stolen. So I came up. I thought that's an adventure. I came up with an idea for Sophie and Brownlow, where they were on the trail of someone who was stealing the dogs of celebrities. And
It's such a great concept, and there's something so lovely about writing the relationship between a human and a dog. Are you an animal lover yourself?
yes, totally. I've been this morning. I've been up, just up above me along the Downslink track to feed my robin that I've fed every day since before Christmas, and he comes out and waits for me and sings. I've always had animals. I don't have a dog at the moment, but I've got a cat and I've got a rabbit. And in the past, I've had axolotls, I've had pigeons that I've been rehabilitating after they've been injured. I've had just about every animal under the sun, really.
I'd love to know about what it is about mystery that appeals to you as a genre. Is it something that you grew up reading or watching?
I've always enjoyed everything from Agatha Christie till at the moment. I watch all the cozy crime on TV. I love Agatha Raisin. I read the books, and Whitstable Pearl and Father Brown. I love all of those shows, and it seems to be a really interesting way of exploring life as well. When you're someone that's got lots of questions, and I look at everything and ask questions about it. So I like the hook of a whodunit and enjoy building that suspense and jeopardy, and thinking, why did that happen? And oh goodness, what's going to happen next? And for Sophie and Brownlow, why I've now got to book three with them, it's because it's really interesting researching how people might commit different pet related or wildlife related crimes, and also how you might stop them. It's not an area you find in many detective books, and it's not an area you find reported a great deal.
No,
So
it's not. And did you do much research with the kind of rural crimes police?
I haven't greatly, though I follow them on social media. But I did some research with someone from Portsmouth University who's a wildlife criminologist. I went to a talk he gave, and then he's been sending me various things specifically on bird of prey crime. So that's been my main research on this one. But I would like to do something with the Rural Crime Unit in future, possibly on the next book in the series.
Yeah, I can see you as the like mystery version of Peter James on the side of the taxis in Brighton.
I think Brownlow would like that. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a picture of the big shaggy dog grinning at you from a taxi? I think he'd like that.
I think that would be lovely. So, Judy, you're based in Shoreham-by-Sea. What's it like to be a writer there?
It's a really nice place to be a writer. I've always lived here. I grew up here. I moved to London for a little while because I was working as a playwright, at the Royal Court and the National. And then I came home again because it's not too long a commute, really. So it's not difficult at all. But it's really nice. I go out bird watching a lot. I've got very into bird watching and like to watch the birds along the estuary and photograph the butterflies in the spring. And so it's a great place for someone that likes watching wildlife.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that you used to be a playwright. What are the big disciplines that are different from playwriting and novel writing?
Playwriting's for me was always easier, and I wasn't to start with very confident about being a novelist because in playwriting I could write as I think, which is basically in Brighton Cockney, and for novel writing I've got to improve my grammar a bit, so I go a bit slower, and for sheer number of words that you use writing a novel. I'm not. That was a shock to me to start with. I thought this novel's nearly finished on my first one, and then I looked at the word count, and it was about 40,000, and it needed to be about 80 plus, didn't it? I mean, yeah. So you learn to be concise as a playwright. You don't really want to be sitting in the theatre while the play goes on for 2.5 hours. I always thought a play should rather be like a punk rock song, like the Ramones or something. You know, you should get in, you should get the impact of it, and then you've got plenty of time to go to the bar. So, for a novel where you want to read a bit and then maybe you want to stop and have your supper, and even if it's a page turner, you're not going to read it in an hour. And just the length of time that it takes to write one, that was the biggest kind of shock to me. I enjoy it, but yeah. I'd keep thinking, am I there yet? Like a kid in the back of the car.
Yeah, I really relate to that. I'm also like very impatient as a person, so I just think, okay, that's done now.
And when you're writing, if you're writing a scene that you want to be exciting and sort of fast-paced, of course, as you're writing it, it's not so fast-paced. So until you read it back through to reassure yourself that it's suspenseful and has got drive and pace to it, when you're actually writing it, it still feels a bit slow to you because you can't write at the pace you can read, or I can't anyway.
No, absolutely not. You'd be hard pressed to find someone that could. So, Judy, what's next for Sophie and Brownlow? Have you got plans?
Yes, I've got an idea for another adventure for them, where they get involved with a rather feisty conservationist who shares her home with wild badgers. She checks her voicemail. Sophie checks her voicemail one day, and the woman's left her a message saying, "I think I've just murdered a murderer." So Sophie goes rushing down there. The woman has actually sent set a really nasty booby trap in her woods, and when she gets there is nobody. So suddenly we're off into another mystery, and later on, I'm sort of halfway through it. It involves a rather high octane paddleboard chase down the River Ada. Sophie's adventures are full of drama, but they're not really James Bond. She's got an old second-hand car, and she often comes rushing to the rescue on southeastern trains. You know, it's
Very, very slowly and probably delayed.
that's right, that's
Thank
right.
you.
Somebody complains about the foot room. Yeah.
Yeah. And someone's drunk.
Yes.
Judy, thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of the Brownlow series?
Okay, the Brownlow series, you can order it from bookshops or from online retailers. You can find out about Brownlow from my publisher. They're Hobart Books, and they're at hobartbooks.com. Brownlow himself is on X at it's at Brownlow PD65, and he's on Instagram at Brownlow Official. And my website is judyupton.co.uk.
Thank you so much for joining us, Judy.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Tom Johnston is a Brighton-based writer and joins us on the show to talk about how his fiction is informed by the city. Tom, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, Anna.
Can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your work?
Yeah, my name's Tom Johnstone, and I am a writer of mainly short fiction in the horror genre and supernatural. I also work as a gardener for the council, and sometimes that finds its way into my work.
So I'd love to talk a bit about Wellsbourne. So for anyone listening, can you explain a bit about it to us and talk about how it inspired your writing?
Well, I first heard about the lost river of Wellsbourne from the local kind of historian and impresario, Dr. David Bramwell, who runs the Catalyst Club. And he and I both worked on the Brighton the graphic novel, which Queen's Park Books brought out. And it was through his story that I heard about Wellsbourne, and I decided to work it into my own fiction. It's the underground river that used to be an overground river through Brighton, and it's where Valley Gardens is now, that area. The spring of it comes from, it's a winterborne stream that comes from starts off in Patcham. So it's the reason why there's often a lot of flooding in Patcham whenever there's a lot of rain, and it runs down the centre of Brighton. King George IV had it covered over because, it wasn't consistent with his vision for what he wanted, what was originally the fishing village of Brighthelmstone to be. And so I decided to make it the basis of my first short fiction collection, because I had a number of published stories and a few unpublished stories that I wanted to kind of like weld together with this loose theme of Wellsbourne. Actually, here's another aside. I don't know if anyone's been through to the Preston Park lately, but they built a slightly controversial tower, not a tower block exactly, but a big housing block right next to it, and it's actually called Wellsbourne. But anyway, so I wrote these I had this kind of various published and unpublished stories that I wanted to put in this collection and have them around the loose theme of Wellsbourne. So some of them are set in Brighton and refer to the River Wellsbourne, and some of them are set in the fictional kind of almost like a twin town of Brighton called Wellsbourne. And I wanted to kind of, in the fantasy world, the horror fiction is generally, it's set in the real world or some kind of post-apocalyptic version of the real world. But there are certain writers who have invented their own kind of imaginary places, like, one of the most obvious ones is Castle Rock. By Stephen King. I made a TV series of it, but a lot of his stories are set there. Also, Lovecraft had the Miskatonic Valley. So again, and he had a series of fictional towns set around this fictional valley. Joel Lane, the Birmingham horror writer, he had a kind of fictional place called Clayhanger in the West Midlands. Ramsay Campbell, again, he's got a kind of fictional Severn Valley place called Brichester. So I wanted it to be along those lines. So basically what I did was I kind of like retrofitted and tinkered around with these stories to either set them, the ones that weren't set in Brighton, put them in Wellsbourne, because they are always set in a fictional place, but I thought they could all be in the same fictional place. And some of the parts of Wellsbourne are based on Brighton anyway, but they're not like obviously Brighton-y bits of Brighton, things like playing fields, like the Wakeman Recreation Ground, it's based on a Brighton playing field.
It's really interesting, and I'd love to know why horror for you? Was it what you grew up reading? What piqued your interest? Because really, you could fit a lot of these things into other genres.
Yeah, a lot of these things into other genres, but yeah, I've always enjoyed horror, and I've always enjoyed literary fiction that kind of touches on horror. Like, for example, I just read this wonderful, wonderful book. I don't know if you've read it, called The Bee Sting. It's all sorts of things. It's a family saga. It's a state of the nation novel, but it also, because it's set in Ireland, it kind of touches on folk horror, which is a very popular genre at the moment. And it's something I used to write before I even knew what folk horror was. I kind of instinctually wrote it, but also, yeah, it was. I read a lot of horror stories when I was much younger. It was my it was a bit of an addiction. And then I kind of like graduated to the more kind of acceptable face of it, which is ghost stories. And so I write a mixture of both. And I've always found it easier to write short fiction than long fiction. And I've always found that the horror story lends itself particularly well to short fiction.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk about three places in Brighton during this chat. So we've covered Wellesbourne, and I'd really like to talk about Brighton Beach next. And in your story, The Coroner's Collector, it plays a big role in that. Can you speak to this?
It's I mean, I suppose, yeah, it's obviously I was drawn to it as a kind of liminal space. So you've got this idea of bodies washing up on the beach and people washing up in Brighton, like misfits and odd people, transients. I just wanted to explore that theme, and I suppose the beach is kind of the metaphor for that. And so, like, the main character is this guy who works for the coronary service. He calls himself a stiff collector. That's what his job is. So he picks up dead bodies from wherever they happen to be found, and he becomes, I think, slightly obsessed with one that's washed up on Brighton Beach. And yeah, so there's all sorts of thoughts around that. And also he has this strange experience of becoming woven into someone else's fiction. So I wanted to use that as a way of exploring the idea of metafiction in a kind of, but using the horror trope of the doppelganger.
No, it's great. It's great. And it's I think you really write Brighton Beach very, very atmospherically in that story. And the third place, which
Thank
really
you.
fascinates me, and we're going to hear an extract, is the Royal Pavilion in The Beast in the Palace. What did you discover about this fascinating part of Brighton when you were writing this story?
Well, one of the things that I found was that there were two royal pavilions. The original one was a smaller, more kind of, I suppose you'd call it, it's more sort of Ionic columns. So it's more like a, if you can imagine, like a colonial house with the columns and a dome. And they built what we know as the Royal Pavilion over it. So it was kind of, in a way, it's a pavilion. It's a building within a building, which is kind of like the way I structured the story as well, because I wanted it to be like a Russian doll structure. You have a story within a story within a story. So it starts off with you hear that in the introduction, you're introduced to this strange character called Caleb Anvil, who's the gardener in the original Pavilion Gardens in the 1830s. And then it pulls back to someone doing some historical research about the links to slavery in the 18th century. And it was partly inspired because I watched the Tom Hardy BBC miniseries, which is set during the early 19th century, during the George IV era. So I thought, hey, this is a great I idea. I think we need a bit more Regency Gothic or Georgian Gothic. And so I thought, why not have a Gothic Roman? Because you have the villain speaks to the female narrator through the mirror, like the opera ghost in The Phantom of the Opera, and also weave in some like history. And then I found out, and it was inspired when I saw two. I went to Brighton Museum, and there were two of the old fashioned kind of cartoons that they had of the time, sort of mocking, quite mercilessly mocking George IV, you know, and his obsession with, like, well, I don't know if it was his obsession, but like someone gave him a giraffe as a present. It was the king of Egypt, the Pasha of Egypt, like the prince of Egypt. So it's all this colonial history, and of course they called it the camel leopard because it looked like a kind of hybrid creature of a camel and a leopard, because it's really long legs, but the speckled spots and the long neck. And of course it's quite tragic really, because it wasn't really suited, you know. It was, they shipped it over and it was having, you know, it must have had a horrible time, probably died before, you know, it wasn't in its having a happy time, this giraffe or camel leopard or whatever they called it. And then I also found out stuff about a local mutiny in New Haven, which provided me with the kind of background for the ending, and the quite tragic and awful ending.
Can we have an extract, please, Tom?
Yeah, sure. This is a scene where the female narrator of the kind of like the main story, the in to talk about the Russian doll again, once all the outer layers of the Russian doll or the onion, if you like, are peeled off. Again, the onion, like the onion domes. That's another thing. What we have is a story of a young woman who escapes from a slave ship because she has the presence of mind to pick away at her shackles, and it happens to sink, and everyone else is drowned, but she escapes. She washes up on in Bright Elmstone, Brighton, rescued by a blind fisherman. Again, a reference to Frankenstein. But then she ends up kind of trafficked to the George the Fourth, and she finds herself locked in this room, and that's where we find her in this sequence. "Let me out," I called, hammering on the door. "Let me out." After several minutes of this, I heard footsteps clacking along the floorboards outside, then a key rattling in the lock. The door opened, and two women stood before me, both wearing white bonnets and aprons over plain black uniforms. "There now," said the older, hard-faced one. "Back to bed with you." "You'll be out soon enough for your bath, missy," the younger one said with a grin. "But your afternoon nap's not finished yet." "Bath?" I answered. "Who has put these clothes on me? Tell me now." "Impudent hussy," the older one hissed, clenching a fist. "I can see I'll have to teach this one some manners, or she won't be fit for him." "He won't thank us for marking her, though," the younger one said, catching her arm. "Why don't we bathe her now, seeing as she's out of bed?" "Did I ask your advice?" "Oh, very well. Come on then, you." They each took an arm and dragged me to the bathhouse, where they washed me in sandalwood and rose water. It calmed me down, the steam and the scents making me so drowsy, I was happy for them to put me back into the giant bed. But I slept lightly and soon awoke to hear the voice for the first time calling to me. It was dark by then, so at first I thought there was someone in the room with me, and I pulled the covers up to my shoulders, even though I knew there would not be much protection if the presence truly meant me harm. "Do not be afraid of me, little one," it whispered, in soft, sweet tones, deep and musical. "I mean you no harm." "Who are you?" I asked. "A friend. One that loves you more dearly than you can know." My eyes were adjusting to the dark, and yet I could see no sign of movement in the room. "Why can I not see you?" I asked, wondering if the speaker had a face as beautiful as his voice.
"I have a sickness that changes me whenever the fire of love takes hold of my heart. That is why I must hide my face from you until you are ready to see it. Come to the mirror on the dressing table tomorrow before sunset, and I shall speak to you again."
I could not sleep after that, thinking about the voice and the words of love it spoke. Lying there in the dark in silken sheets, dreaming in my wakefulness about the possible face of the speaker, I quite forgot I was a prisoner.
Thank you so much, Tom. You should be a voice actor. That was fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
So I'd love to know what your experience is being a writer in Brighton. Is this a good place to write?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a wonderful place. There's always lots of inspiration in the landscape and the people. Yeah, I really need to kind of get more involved in the writing community here, I think.
Absolutely, there's plenty going on. So I know you've got some events in the pipeline. Can you tell us about them?
On April the 29th, I am taking part in a panel at Waterstones on fabulous villains. It's Waterstones in Covent Garden, this is, so it's not a local event. So it's not in Brighton. However, a few days later in Brighton, at Found Cafe, I will be hosting a series of frightening horror stories, if I can find some other writers to come and read them. But around the theme of spring, I'm calling it The Fright of Spring. So yeah, if anyone's interested and wants to do a reading, come along then. And I'm going to get more organized with that. But Found Cafe is in Brighton. It's opposite Preston Park, in fact, on the street called Preston Drove.
How
And
can
it's all
people
nice.
find and follow you, Tom, and hear more about how they can get involved with these events?
Well, I have a blog on WordPress, tomjohnstone.wordpress.com. You can find me on Facebook at Tom's Tales of Terror. And I'm on Instagram just as at TomJohnstone02, on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Len of the Rovers, and Blue Sky. I'm also on Blue Sky. I think that's just like the Sky app with my name on it.
Thank you
But
so much, Tom, for joining us. And we look forward to seeing what new work you come up with soon.
yes, thank you very much. And also, I would say my other collection, Let Your Hinged Jaw Do the Talking, is available in the Jubilee Library and some local independent bookshops.
There are a few things that I enjoy more than an evening at Waterstones Brighton in front of, well, sitting and watching wonderful authors in conversation. And I'm really, really excited to be joined by Sam from Waterstones Brighton, who heads up the events there, to talk about what they've got going on through April and May. Sam, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi there.
So, what can we expect in the next few months at Waterstones Brighton?
So on the 1st of April, then we've got Elif Shafak, who a lot of people will have heard of. She has written many, many fantastic books, sort of literary fiction. She's a sort of British Turkish author, and she's written titles like Island of Missing Trees, 40 Rules of Love, Daughters of Eve, all hugely popular. And she is sort of a multi award winner and nominee. The book that we are doing the event on is the paperback release of There Are Rivers in the Sky, which lots of people have been, saying it's her best book yet. And it's kind of 19th century, set in the 19th century, based around three characters, three really kind of vibrant characters who live on either the sort of banks of the River Thames or the Tigris, and they've all been kind of touched in some way by the epic of Gilgamesh. So it's a really kind of expansive, sort of vibrant book that's very, very beautiful.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. And who will Elif be in conversation with?
So, with our favorite interviewer, Alexandra Hemmingsley, she does a lot of our interviews for us. She's such a professional, and we love getting her on board whenever she's available.
Excellent. What next?
So we also have, again, another fiction title. Jennifer Saint will be coming to the shop. So the Elif Shafak event actually is at Wagon Hall, which is just, it's very close to the shop. The Jennifer Saint event will be in the shop on Wednesday, the 16th of April. Now, this is going to be Jennifer's fourth book in her sort of Greek retelling series. So she's already done Atalanta, Electra, Ariadne. She's now got Hera out in the series. It's out in hardback. This is going to be for the paperback release. So this is, as the title suggests, all about the character of Hera, but it's kind of a fresh take on this character. She's the sister of Zeus. She's a much maligned character, in Greek myth, meant, represented as being quite cruel, quite jealous. And I think what Jennifer Saint's doing here is trying to put a sort of a fresh take on this particular character. So, it's nice. I see it as a quite nice sort of feminist retelling of this character.
Okay, what's next?
So, Chris Whitaker. So, crime fiction essentially, but I think this book appeals to everybody. All the Colours of the Dark. Again, it's been out in hardback. This is to celebrate the paperback release. People might know him for We Begin at the End, won the Gold Dagger in 2021. Hugely popular book. But All the Colours of the Dark, has just taken off. You just, you know, you see it everywhere. You see, you know, President Biden's wife reading it on the beach. You know, everyone seems to be buzzing about this book. It's a very, very expansive book. It's essentially about two characters, and in many ways I'd call their story a love story, but not in the traditional sense. This is a book about young girls going missing, about a serial killer, about a hunt, a very personal hunt that spans many, many years. It is a beautiful, a terrific, a very emotional book. And we have been selling so many in hardback, and the paperback is going to be absolutely huge.
That sounds so good. Going to the top of my reading list.
Oh, honestly. And our both managers here are sort of crazy about this book, and both kind of fighting to be the one to interview him. But Rich will be interviewing Chris Whitaker, and he's a terrific interviewer, our manager here.
Excellent. Okay, moving forward.
So I am sure most of your listeners will be familiar with the sort of Court of Thorns and Roses phenomenon. And there is a 10-year celebration coming up. So we have got a big party celebration coming up, the Accutane celebration party on Tuesday, the 29th of April. So there's no authors there. It's like a fan-based event. We do hold quite a few of those, actually. We had a great one for the Hunger Games the other night. And, Sunrise on the Reaping, I should say. And this will be Tuesday, the 29th of April, to mark 10 years of Court and Thorns and Roses series by Sarah J. Maas. And there is going to be sort of a new release of some special editions of those books as well coming out on that particular date.
Excellent. Will there be fancy dress?
We always encourage fancy dress at these events. Yeah, we had some brilliant costumes at the Court of Thorn and Roses midnight launch the other night. Some of those, you can see those on our socials. But yeah, fancy dress, 100%.
Excellent. Okay, what's next?
So going into May then, we've got Chris Carter on the 6th of May. He's, again, it's a paperback release of The Death Watcher. This is a series, the Robert Hunter series, who he's like a criminal behavioural psychologist turned detective. Very, very dark, very grisly, quite sort of violent crime fiction titles these. He's got a huge fan base, and this one is actually almost sold out. He's born in Brazil, moved to the States. I think these books are sort of largely autobiographical, you know, because he also worked as a criminal psychologist for a while before becoming a rock star and then going back to full-time, then starting a career as a full-time writer. I think this one is going to be a really, really interesting event. Big fan base, very, very interesting author. Going to be a good one.
Oh my gosh, that's so much to look forward to. Is there anything else we need on our radars?
We've always got Crime Wave events going on. So Crime Wave events will have once a quarter, and lovely Stu Cummins, who is got a very big profile on Instagram, he always chairs these. We've got Joe Callahan and Jack Jordan are our next one, 15th of May. And then future ones, we've got people like Lisa Jewell. I don't know whether we've got those actually on the website yet. And it's not all fiction, of course. We've got Gaz Oakley, vegan chef, Plant to Plate. We've done an event with him before, and he brought along some lovely nibbles to try, so I'm hoping that will be happening again. So yeah, we have non-fiction events as well, and we've got lots more in the pipeline They haven't necessarily been confirmed yet, but they'll all be going up on the website as soon as they are.
Sam, you must love your job.
I absolutely love it. Yes.
I'm jealous in many ways. So, Sam, how can people get tickets to the Waterstones events? We're going to link them all up on the Brighton Book Club Instagram page, but how can we get tickets via Waterstones?
Okay, so you can go onto the Waterstones website and there is a link for events and a drop-down menu just to choose either which branch or which author or which dates. You can do it that way. That will give you a link to Eventbrite. You could just go onto Eventbrite, do a search there, or pop into the shop. We can sell you a ticket from the till as well.
Thank you so much for joining us, Sam.
Thank you.
If you are a writer in and around Brighton, then you absolutely need to know about New Writing South's Publishing Industry Day. This is a day programmed to help empower you as an author, meet agents, find out about publishing, to know your rights as an author, and find out how you can win competitions and prizes. I'm joined by co-director of New Writing South, Anna Jefferson, to talk about the Industry Day and how it could benefit you as a writer. Anna, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me again, Anna.
You're becoming a regular.
We could co-host our own show.
If the world needs anything, it doesn't need.
Two Annas
talking any more than I already do. So let's talk about the Publishing Industry Day. Can you talk us through the events?
Absolutely. So the event is taking place on Saturday, the 26th of April. It's in Brighton in the old courtrooms, just opposite Brighton Dome. And we've got a really exciting programme this year, I hope. And it's the intention of the whole day is to look at different ways of being able to support writers, to be able to inform them, and to also kind of make those connections with other writers and people in the industry. So it's quite a packed day this year. We've got four different panels. The first is around your rights as a writer. And this feels really important at the moment with everything that's going on in the world and everything that's the uncertainty around things like AI. On the panel, we start the day off with an opening keynote from Anna Ganley, and she is the CEO of the Society of Authors. And then the panel following that is around your rights as a writer. And that's with Anna again. And we have somebody from the Writers Guild. We have the chief exec from ALCS. And it's chaired by a brilliant agent from Anna Nunberg Associates. We follow that on with a second panel, which is around independent publishing. This is with different publishers from Muswell Press. We have People Tree Press and Hera, and that is chaired by a writer, one of our brilliant writers, Umi Singer. Then in the afternoon, we've got some agents who are coming along as well, from Seventh Agency, from AM Heath, from Andrew Nunberg again, and from C&W as well, which is part of Curtis Brown. And then finally, the final panel is around competitions and prizes. And that's looking at things about how, just how useful they are, how they can support writers and different ways into the industry that isn't maybe going down the most conventional route. And we have somebody from the Jalak Prize, from the Polari Prize, a brilliant writer, Victoria Lord Barlow, who has been a longlisted from the Booker Prize. And Aki, who's the director of the Literary Consultancy, is going to be chairing that panel. So, yeah, really, really busy day. And just to say as well, the end of the day is everybody goes for a drink in the pub over the road. And so they get a chance to meet each other in person then as well.
It sounds really great. And I think what really is at the heart of this day is to empower authors to have as much knowledge as possible about the industry and about how they can get their foot in the door. This is something that is really important to New Writing South as an organisation. But as a writer yourself, how would this day have benefited you early on in your career?
I think it's often difficult to go to one place where you can get all the information. There's often things that are focused on one aspect of the craft or or different areas that you might be able to find things out about, but to be able to find out, to meet independent publishers, agents, to be able to find out practically what your rights are, and also to be able to get that information around competitions and prizes all in one place, I think is really it's I think it's essential, really. I think it's tricky to be able to, as a writer, feel that you can kind of go into a space and come out and think like, right, this is my plan, kind of a bit of a blueprint. And I think that's what these kind of days are really good for. I think the fact that you've got opportunities to actually meet people in person as well and kind of have Q&As and ask those kind of burning questions. So for me as a writer, I never really knew where to go. There's bigger things that you can go to, and probably things that maybe kind of end up spending a lot more time, potentially a lot more money, like going to things like London Book Fair, which are fantastic, but your time can be spread quite thinly. Whereas if you can go to somewhere and just have like a shot in the arm of like everything you need to know, and then also meet people who are at different stages of their career as well. So I think that's probably also something quite important to say, that these days aren't intended for people who are kind of on their third, fourth book or this kind of thing. This is for people who, from early stage career right up until the point where you might be really established, and that might be one of your kind of main forms of income. There's something for everybody in these days.
Thank you so much, Anna. It sounds like a really, really excellent day. How can people get a ticket?
So to get a ticket, if you go onto the New Writing South website, which is newwritingsouth.co.uk, and then you'll be able to find out all the information about Publishing Industry Day in terms of also a bit more information about the panels and all the panelists, and then you'll be able to find the link as well there to be able to get yourself a ticket.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Anna.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next month with two fantastic Brighton-based writers, Lauren Bravo talking about her new book, Probably Nothing, and Emma Jane Unsworth discussing her fantastic new novel, Slags. Plus, we've got an interview with Andrew Flewitt talking about Do You Believe in Love After Loss? Queer stories of loss, hope, and resilience. If you have enjoyed the show, please do rate us wherever you get your podcasts from. And you can listen to previous episodes of the book club on the Radio Reverb website. Follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club, and do consider donating to Radio Reverb's Reverbathon to keep us online, independent, and bringing great book content to you. We'll see you next month.